And you are tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz at freakradio.org and 101.3 FM. I'm Robert Norris. Coming up for the next 2 hours, it's the May 3rd, 2018 edition of Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides, twice-weekly show concerned with homeless civil rights and, oh, whatever strikes my fancy. And we'll see if it strikes yours, so stay tuned.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
So I'm going to begin with a couple of stories sent to me by RV full-timers activist Julie Scholl, who I run into frequently at the Red Church meal, which will not be going for the next month. The Calvary Episcopal Church at Lincoln and Cedar is redoing its roof for dealing with internal asbestos problems, or who knows what they're doing. But in any case, it's no meals for the next month, which is a kind of a sad thing for folks who come to the Monday meal, what with meals having been cut off by the Homeless Lack of Services Center 2 years ago. Though Food Not Bombs does continue, it's Saturday and Sunday meals at 4 o'clock outside the main post office. But here's a story by Julia Sol sent me. Felony abuse charges dropped against Joshua Tree parents living in Desert Shack, CBS, Los Angeles. Let's see how the mainstream media covers it.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Sandra Mitchell.
And I'm Juan Fernandez. Our top story on KCAL 9 News at Noon is breaking news on the parents who were arrested after they were found with their three children living in a shed in the Joshua Tree Desert. Felony charges of child abuse against Daniel Panico and Mona Kirk have just been dismissed by a judge.
However, they will face misdemeanor charges, including child endangerment. The family was found living in these deplorable conditions back in February. And, of course, we're going to bring you more information on this story as soon as we get it.
However, if you look at the longer story, which, let me make sure I've got this properly configured. If you look at the longer story that is mentioned on the CBS LA website, the print story reads as follows. Felony child abuse charges were dropped Wednesday against a couple found living in a makeshift desert shack earlier this year on a Joshua Tree property. The felony charges against Daniel Panico, 73, and Mona Kirk, 51, were dismissed by the San Bernardino County DA's office. They were replaced by three misdemeanor counts, each of child endangerment and failure to address truancy. The new charges mean that they will not have to serve time in state prison and can seek employment, assuming they're convicted, of course. The parents appeared in San Bernardino County Superior Court Wednesday, where they pled not guilty to the new misdemeanor charges. The judge also issued a new order which will allow them to contact and visit their children. How nice of him or her. On March 1st, San Bernardino County Sheriff's deputies arrested the couple after going to their property in the 7,000 block of Sunfair Road, where they discovered a makeshift tent and a trailer. Deputies learned that the couple and their three children, ages 11 to 14, had been living there for 4 years without running water, bathrooms, or electricity. The property had mounds of trash and human feces strewn about. Inside a trailer, deputies also found 30 to 40 cats. The children were not enrolled in public school, and there was no evidence they were being educated. However, at the time of the arrest, friends came to the couple's defense, arguing they were good parents who were poor, not neglectful. Dozens of people rallied in support of the couple outside their first court hearing in March, holding signs that read, "Being homeless is not a crime, and poverty is not a choice." "I don't think they're guilty of anything other than being poor," Leanna Monroe, a friend of the couple, said. "The family is a giving, caring, loving family. The children didn't have any obvious injuries and showed no outward signs of malnutrition," officials said. Their attorneys argued that rather than arrest the couple, deputies should have called family services and allowed the matter to proceed through dependency court rather than criminal court. Panico and Kirk are due back in court on June 29th. And here's a little of an earlier story. Friends defend Joshua Tree couple accused of child cruelty and abuse.
In court this afternoon.
A lot of people showed up to defend their character. KCAL9's Peter Dowd is here tonight with a closer look at this case and those parents in court today.
Yeah, Jeff and Lena, when this story broke yesterday, the details were horrifying. Kids living in a plywood shack. But outside court today, the parents and their supporters said people have this all wrong.
I'm wondering why all this has happened.
Daniel Panico appeared in court today and seemed confused about the child abuse charges he and Mona Kirk are facing.
It's ridiculous.
Deputies say the couple and their kids, ages 11, 13, and 14, were living in this plywood shack in Joshua Tree.
I don't think they're guilty of anything other than being poor.
Outside the courtroom, friends of the couple defended them.
This family is a giving, caring, loving family. The kids come over, they're happy, they're always well-dressed, they're always polite, they're very smart, they're always clean.
Leanna Monroe says the family lost their house a few years ago. She says they stayed with a friend, then bought the land in Joshua Tree. But she says the family did not have enough money to build a home, so they built the shack.
I am not agreeing that this is the perfect situation for them to live in, but their home was, where are they supposed to live?
Marcia Custodio says the parents were not on welfare and never asked for help because they feared exactly what's happened.
Their home was important. They need help. They don't need their kids taken away. They need help.
Kirk and Panico are each being held on $300,000 bail, and they're due back in court next week. Their kids are now in the custody of Child Protective Services. Back to you.
So that's a pretty horrendous story. Actually, there's more in the written online version of this KNX 1070 story from CBS Los Angeles. Mentions it's a hovel toppled together with plywood and plastic sheeting. Couple and three children, age 11 to 14. The mother is 51, who sleeps alongside them in the ramshackle dwelling, only 4 feet high and 10 feet wide. Father, 73, slept in a trailer on the property with dozens of cats. In another vehicle, scraps of plywood that were put together, and then they had a tarp over it to keep out the rain. Blankets were strewn everywhere. Chairs were used to try to hold up the tarp ceiling. A makeshift kitchen was littered with empty bottles, cans of corn, peas, and soup stacked on wooden shelves. Several holes on the property were filled with feces, officials said. It was apparent they had not bathed in days, she said. There was no running water, no electricity, no bathroom facilities. A telephone number listed for the couple in public records was not in service. Deputies believe the family lost their home at some point and has been living on the dirt lot for about 4 years. Initially, the whole family was living in a trailer, and they later built the plywood dwelling. She said temperatures in the desert community regularly reach over 100 degrees during the summer and can drop well below freezing during very windy winter nights. They range from 20 to 30 degrees at night or even lower depending on the wind chill, Bachman said. Temperatures are very cold, and they were basically living outdoors. There was no indoors for them. Friend Marcia Custodio, who we heard from, I think, earlier in the news broadcast, said the family's living situation is clearly not ideal. "I'm not agreeing that this is the perfect situation for them to live in," Custodio said, "but they are homeless. Where are they supposed to live?" She said the family never asked for help, fearing what happened Thursday with an arrest might happen. "They're helpless and poor, and they need help. They don't need the kids taken away. They need help." Investigators do not believe the children are being held captive, like another family who lived about 60 miles east of Joshua Tree that made international headlines earlier this year when officials said they had rescued their 13 children. And here's a final story, again, from KNX, probably repeating some of the same details, but it's an example of the kind of slant that the mainstream news media, at least the audio or the video portion, because this is also a video as well as an audio, you can go online and see it, does. Whereas if you look a little deeper, you catch more of the details. There are a few of the details come out, that is to say the fact that these are necessary sort of circumstances for these folks. At least that's what their neighbors are saying. And I probably their neighbors know a hell of a lot better than news media, child protective services, deputies, and courts. But let's listen to the news media.
Was released from jail today as they await trial. CBS2's Tina Patel spoke with the couple who say they've never hurt their children, and now they're getting new support from the community.
Daniel Panico and Mona Kirk are still facing multiple charges of felony child abuse, but they are now out of jail, released after a judge decided they were not a flight risk. We caught up with the couple at the Joshua Tree property where they had been living with their three kids, ages 11, 13, and 14. They admit they don't have a lot of money and have let trash pile up.
Going to totally normal, but our place here, it doesn't look totally normal.
They say they used to stay in a trailer, but the water pump broke and they couldn't afford to fix it. Last summer, their kids built a makeshift fort out of some old boxes, and they'd occasionally sleep there.
We're always all together, and they were never in any danger. You know, yes, it's messy, but, you know, they never got hurt. They were always well-fed. They were the center of our lives.
The couple is still in shock that they were arrested and their children taken away to stay with relatives. They're not allowed to communicate with them right now.
I want to say it's ridiculous. We didn't do anything wrong.
They're grateful that friends and neighbors are not only standing by their side, but also supporting them, raising more than $20,000 to help them find more permanent housing.
That is just so wonderful and
encouraging, and we appreciate and we thank all those people.
Thank you.
The couple is due back in court on March 13th. They're hoping they'll be able to reunite with their children after that. In Joshua Tree, Tina Patel, CBS 2 News.
And if you look at the video that accompanies that story, you see the, I guess, presumably neighbors carrying signs, homelessness is not a crime, these people are not guilty, poverty is not a crime. There are a couple more details in the story, and apparently they were finally released, not just because they aren't a flight risk, but they couldn't afford their $300,000 bail. Kirk's attorney, Elizabeth Crabtree, said she and Panico's attorney will argue next week the couple deserve to be reunited with their children. They'll argue for the charges to be dropped. I don't think there's anything at this point that substantiates abuse, Crabtree said, adding the couple should never have been arrested. And there's more that I think I've read before. We have the sheriff's spokeswoman coming on with Cindy Bachman saying that children didn't appear to have any obvious injuries and showed no outward signs of malnutrition, but as a parent, they had not bathed in days. They were very stinky. Maybe she would offer to let them take showers at her house, perhaps. And again, there's more of the discussion of how people rallied at the courthouse. In a jailhouse interview with the LA Times, Panico said his family had been torn apart. He and his wife did nothing wrong. We're just minding our own business, trying to raise our three kids on little money. Crabtree said that rather than arrest the couple, deputies should have called Child and Family Services, allowed the matter to proceed, as mentioned before, through dependency court rather than criminal court. Miss Kirk misses her children very much, Crabtree said. She's keeping her head up, knowing she's going to see them again. And that pretty much covers it, because some of what is mentioned in this written story was already spoken of in the video report. Panico and Kirk planned to build a home on the land where they were living, but as time went by, they had used all the money they had for living expenses, wrote Jackie Clear, the friend who started the fundraiser. Any money they got from side jobs and such was spent on their kids, food, and the basic necessities, she wrote. The kids were fed, healthy, and were part of just about any activity or group that was available to the community. And that's, again, from March 6th story. They were never in any danger, California parents who housed kids in desert shack released.
Equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex.
proposed to make the law state men and women equal. But little did we know just how long the fight would go, and even now we're working on its sequel.
According to Wikipedia, the Equal Rights Amendment is a proposed amendment, still proposed, to the United States Constitution designed to guarantee equal legal rights for all American citizens regardless of sex. Of course, you can always be droned, even if you're an American citizen, and put on the presidential assassination list, thanks to Obama and his predecessors and successors, but we won't get into that. It seeks to end the legal distinctions between men and women in terms of divorce, property, employment, and other matters. It was originally written by Alice Paul and Crystal Eastman. The amendment was introduced in Congress for the first time in October 1921, that's almost 100 years ago, and has prompted conversations about the meaning of legal equality for women and men ever since. How nice. Conversations, indeed. In the early history of the Equal Rights Amendment, middle-class women were largely supportive, whilst those speaking for the working class were often opposed, pointing out that the employed women needed special protections regarding working conditions and employment hours. With the rise of the women's movement in the United States during the 1960s, the ERA garnered increasing support after being reintroduced by U.S. Representative Martha Griffiths, Democrat of Michigan, in 1971. It was approved by the U.S. House of Representatives on October 12th of that year, and on March 22nd the next year, 1972, it was approved by the U.S. Senate, thus submitting the ERA to state legislatures for ratification as provided for by Article 5 of the U.S. Constitution. Congress had originally set a ratification deadline of March 22, 1979, for the state legislatures to consider the ERA. Through 1977, the amendment received 35 of the necessary 38 state legislature ratifications. With wide bipartisan support, including that of both major political parties, both houses of Congress, and Presidents Nixon, Ford, and Carter, the ERA seemed destined for ratification until Phyllis Schlafly mobilized conservative women in opposition, arguing that ERA would disadvantage housewives and cause women to be drafted into the military. So now we have women in the military without the ERA. Four states purportedly rescinded their ERA ratifications before the original 1979 deadline. However, there is no precedent or mechanism within the U.S. Constitution for rescinding. Thus, it becomes a legal question. And in a move that was controversial at the time, Congress passed by simple majorities in each chamber, and President Carter signed a joint resolution in 1978 purporting to extend the ratification deadline to June 30, 1982. But because no additional state legislatures ratified the ERA between March 22, 1979 and June 30, 1982, the validity of that disputed extension was rendered academic. On March 22, 2017, the 45th anniversary of Congress's submission of the ERA to the nation's state lawmakers, and I would say almost the 100th anniversary, 95th anniversary of its being proposed, the Nevada legislature became the first and so far the only to ratify the ERA after the expiration of the original 1979, or for that matter, the contested 1982 revised deadline. With its adoption of Senate Joint Resolution Number 2 and published verbatim in the Congressional Record. And there's a lot more on that in Wikipedia, and hopefully I will find an even better website to review and present these matters to you. Lots of interesting stuff, though, and you got some of it. So now it's time for a few announcements about upcoming events. I would go into the city council agenda that's coming up next Tuesday, but I don't have it yet. Only the privileged council members get access to it. And, of course, there's no way for the citizenry to get any kind of access to actually the mayor who sets the city council agenda. You can try to arrange an appointment with Mayor Terrasas, I suppose, but there's no open process for having the community put something on the city council that they want put on the agenda. That must await another era. But hopefully I should have more information about all that on Sunday when the council agenda, at least part of it, though not the part of it which concerns the claims against the city, will be online. That you have to ask for in a special email to City Hall to get. They still are keeping that from the public. There's another event coming up on Friday connected with a sort of a smear job being done on homeless and disabled people around the recent sexual assault purportedly by a man named Daisuke Muro, 41-year-old Santa Cruz man, who is prominently described and repeatedly described in this Jessica York smear story as homeless. So, for instance, when you have, it's been pointed out by Denise Ehrlich in a letter, or actually in commentary in an earlier story by Jessica York, or perhaps it's in this same story. The story I'm looking at is Public Outcry Follows Sexual Assault at Santa Cruz Town Clock. I'm looking for her. Denise Ehrlich, who's a community activist from Aptos, and part of the movement to support things like needle exchange and other harm reduction activities, notes that while Wednesday's attack, this was a week ago Wednesday, I think, was sad and tragic, Ehrlich felt that the accompanying anti-homeless rhetoric was outsized compared to response drawn from recent sexual offenses alleged against everyone from local health care providers and teachers to surfing instructors and correctional officers. You may remember the, the point is that you don't say housed so-and-so accused of sexual assault, but the word homeless nice fits in very well with the prejudices of the Sentinel and the hysterical prejudices of groups like Take Back Santa Cruz and looks like the majority of the Santa Cruz City Council. It's also an attack, York's journalism, on the those with mental ill designations. Even though nor formal diagnosis has been related to his mental health designation, his being the accused, and I repeat, accused, though quite probable, assailant of this woman at the town clock, Sarah Shinsky, I believe is her story, who kind of joins in the general pile-on against homeless people, who writes, or at least York quotes her as saying, she felt bystander help was slow in coming due to a community that was desensitized to homeless people screaming. I feel as if our town, she writes, is being taken over by the mentally ill, and I will want to be able to help him, but at the same time, we don't have enough patrolling out there to keep us all safe. I guess you have to ask yourself how many times people are being assaulted by folks, whether they're homeless, housed, mentally ill, or simply spiritually ill, like most of the Santa Cruz City Council and other politicians and the entire police structure and Parks and Rec and deputy structure in our town. And, of course, Take Back Santa Cruz, according to York, is claims an 18,000 member a vigilante group. I use the word vigilante. York does not. They're planning a 7 p.m. event tomorrow, hence I'm discussing this story in the sort of the event section of this broadcast. It's going to start at 7 o'clock at the town clock. I may be there. It's a community engagement walk. It's designed to peacefully assemble to support each other and our local businesses in taking back our streets for a safer downtown. Taking back our streets from whom? Does this mean driving away more poor people from the streets? Under the smear job phony claim that they are the danger to people out there, that pisses me off. And then, of course, Santa Cruz Councilwoman Rochelle Naroyan, according to York, has posted on her Facebook page a suggestion for a urging state lawmakers to support a pending state Senate bill that would establish a procedure for counties to elect to participate in the appointment of a conservator for a person who is chronically homeless, notice there we go, the H word, and incapable of caring for the person's own health and well-being due to acute and severe mental illness or a severe substance abuse. You might think, oh, that sounds reasonable, maybe. But there actually already is a provision for 5150 and conserving such a person if they are unable to take care of themselves or they are danger to self or danger to others. This, however, says if you have a, if you're diagnosed having an acute and severe mental illness, and that's undefined, or a severe substance abuse, then your rights can be taken away from you without any showing that you're a danger to yourself, danger to others, or even gravely disabled. That's what Laura's Law has done at a state level and is with a county option buy-in, which has been done by numerous counties, though not yet by Santa Cruz, indicating that if you had a history of being picked up by cops for a psychiatric hold, that is, and have a history of not wanting to take medications which the good doctors have decided you need, even if you've decided otherwise based on things like tardive dyskinesia and other dangerous side effects to these medications, or indications from researchers and other doctors that medicating oneself heavily actually reduces one's chances of recovering from personal crises and so-called mental illness conditions. Anyway, there's an implication here that people who are mentally ill are violent, and that they need to be controlled and contained. And that's simply false in terms of, I think, I want to make sure that I'm accurate in my statistics here. So I'll have to say it is my impression that that's not the case. It's often the claim of those who are supportive of folks with mental health conditions that that's a myth that is spread that has to do with more like the fear of the outsider rather than any kind of actual statistical evidence that there's more violence with people who are given mental health, mental illness designations. So anyway, come on down to the town clock, 7 o'clock tomorrow, if you want to meet the gang that wants to run the homeless off the streets and make sure the mentally ill get locked up and the treatment that they so desperately need. That's probably an unfair statement. There are only a few people who've said that, but one fears that it is a mantra that is being more widely heard and certainly being amplified by York and the Sentinel.